Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back. I was in, 24 hours ago, I was in Miami and it was about 85 and sunny. And now I'm in Washington, D.C., which is expecting yet another ice slash snowstorm, 5 to 7 inches, they're alleging. So it's amazing how that happened.
Poor baby is getting 6 inches of snow. How will you ever survive?
Well, look though, but I've become accustomed to a certain lifestyle, Bill, of South Florida weather, and now you're asking me to subject myself to potentially, more school and work absences. So it's a tough gig.
Well, the bigger crisis up north is that it's been so cold, it's been so sub-zero that the maple sap is not flowing yet.
Wow,
The
that's late.
daytime temperatures need to hit in the 40s. It's gonna be freezing at night, hit the 40s in the day for that sap to loosen up, and it's not moving yet. The sugar shacks are open though, so there's still there's plenty of maple syrup from the last season. So people just should not hesitate to visit Western Massachusetts and hit the sugar shacks on the weekend. This
Now,
is the
is there
time. This is
a
the harbinger of spring right here.
Now, is there a difference between, like, can you taste the difference between fresh versus last year syrup?
Absolutely not.
Okay,
No difference at all.
so for all pra by all pra you know all practical purposes, you're good to go. You can go to the sugar shack, you're fine.
Absolutely.
Okay, crisis
And the
averted.
best stuff. The best stuff, the grade B, although they recently just reconfigured their grades because no one was buying the grade B. They thought it meant it was worse,
Yeah.
but it's not true. It's just very dark. They now call it grade A, very dark, or something like that. That stuff always gets tapped at the end of the season anyway, so you never get the best stuff till the season is tapering off in the end of March, early April. But nevertheless, you have these restaurants, these sort of a little homey restaurants that are only open for 6 weeks in little rustic shacks in the dotting in the rural hills, and you only can do it this time of year. So this is your chance to visit in the what's known as the mud season. So Matt, and I know people want to come up to New Hampshire and check out the Republican candidates. This is just on the way, right. You're close to the northwest corner, Keene. Just stop in to get some pancakes, some bacon and eggs, and then head on over and see your favorite Republican candidates stump up a storm.
Hey, it sounds you could do worse. Sounds like a pretty good trip. What's not to like? Republican candidates and pancakes and bacon and eggs.
You went the wrong way. You
Ron
went you were
Swanson.
following the candidates south
Ron
in
Swanson would
Florida
be proud of
while
me.
you abandoned us last week.
Well, yeah, I try to avoid events where I may come into contact with regular people. And so CPAC was happening. And I'm joking, of course. Absolutely love regular people. CPAC was happening, and that's obviously going to be widely covered. It's not like it's not like there's any dearth of journalists crawling around the hallways of CPAC or watching the speeches. So I was blessed to go to Florida Palm Beach. Where the Club for Growth was having a conference, much it was just a few hundred of their donors meeting at their winter meeting. I was actually a guest participant. I was on a panel that was off the record, but the presidential candidates who spoke there, their session was on the record, and there were a handful of journalists who were allowed to cover those on the record sessions. And I picked
Now
up,
what? Now what is the value of a conference, with a panel of pundits speaking off the record? Obviously, you can't speak about it, but can you say why they would construct it that way?
Well, no, I just, honestly, it's that the conference is generally off the record completely, and they made an exception this year for the presidential candidates to have their sessions be on the
Gotcha.
record. So that's basically what it was. Not to say that some of the things I
Okay.
said, not to say that some of the things I said weren't completely confidential and super secretive, but that's basically how it shakes out that way. But
Can you tell me if you got booed at all?
there were no boos. But But there were some good Q&A, but I can't go into it. I can say that that I did see Jeb, Cruz, Rubio, and Walker all speak, and there were some other speeches I did not go to. But those are the four.
So I'd say that you're coming out of CPAC and all, you know, Walker is still kind of the most talked about candidate, but coming off of some of your commentary before, and there's still questions as you're ready for prime time.
Yeah.
Jeb was seen as surviving CPAC, that he didn't overly pander, stuck to his guns in immigration and Common Core, but seemed comfortable in his own skin, all that. But Walker coming up strong in the straw poll, just behind Rand Paul, though no one takes the Rand Paul victory very seriously. Do you get a different flavor of where the candidate stands, seeing them up close in a different kind of event that got less coverage?
Yeah, I think it was a really interesting juxtaposition. I mean, first of all, obviously the weather, you know, you have Washington, D.C., CPAC was snowy and icy, and then Palm Beach, totally different environment. You have CPAC being sort of a wholesale event where the candidates are speaking to, you know, thousands of people versus this conclave where they're speaking to just a few hundred. CPAC's obviously mostly activists, conservative activists. The Club for Growth audience is, mostly political donors. So a different audience, much more intimate in Florida. Both important. I think that really candidates need to be able to perform well in both. And but it was interesting. I had takeaways from each speech. I missed some of Jeb's because I was delayed, believe it or not, coming in out of D.C. with the airplane. But I saw the most important part where he talked about immigration. He actually brought that up himself. So there was a Q&A. Each session in Florida had a Q&A attached to it at the end. And rather than wait for a question, Jeb proactively brought up immigration and did not back down. I think he answered it very well, and he did not look weak or defensive. He was, strong, and I think
has he said now that if he's for a pathway to citizenship or not? I feel like he's been a little confusing about that in the past.
Well, he has been confusing about it, but I'd have to look at my notes. But I think he was. My recollection is that he was very strongly and clearly in favor of a pathway to citizenship. What I heard in Florida, but you're right. He wrote a book that seemed to, a year or two ago. So he has been confusing on that, but now I think that he's coming down strongly. Rubio just is amazingly good all the time. So that's not really a surprise. Walker did not do himself any favors in Florida. It was sort of, everyone I talked to was basically disappointed, including other journalists who were there, in Walker's performance. And he seems very wedded to whatever the issue is that you ask him about. All he wants to talk about is what he did in Wisconsin and fighting against regulations and unions. And he's saying that, like, the only thing people care about are fiscal issues in the economy. And he's using this as a crutch, I would argue. In some cases, he's trying to, sort of say, well, in the case of ISIS, foreign policy, I've shown that I'm tough, and that's the most important thing. I was able to stare down the unions and fight them. And okay, that's not an absurd argument, but I don't know how long it lasts. In the case of social issues, he's basically saying, when people don't care about social issues, the people I talk to care about fiscal issues. And that, I don't know how long he can get away with that. And I got the sense in Florida that it's not going to be long. There's a lot of people thinking he's, maybe not quite ready for prime time.
Well, I mean, is it really unfair of Walker to want to, stick to his strongest message and the strongest part of his record? I mean, don't, as a presidential candidate, don't you need to have, a brand, a calling card, something that makes you stand out for everyone else? That's what makes him stand out. He is a governor who got his agenda accomplished in a blue state. Why wouldn't he want to bring everything back to that?
I think it's a matter of finesse and a matter of degrees. I completely agree with you. That should be his message. message. But you know, look, staying on message is a very delicate thing. If people know you're doing it, you're not doing it right, you know? And so I think that there's a way to sort of subtly stick to your strong suit, emphasize your strength. That's very subtle that people don't catch on to, but it's become very clear that Walker is doing that really out of necessity, out of desperation. It's not just that he wants to emphasize his bona fides as a governor, you know, who survived in a blue or purple state and thrived. In fact, won 3 elections in 4 years, I believe. But it's also a sense that he just can't talk about foreign policy and social issues adequately, and so that this is a crutch. And once people get this sense that, you know, once they sort of smell blood, then you're in trouble. And I think that's where he's headed.
Now, all the talk in Republican circles, I feel like almost going back, you know, at least 3 years, has been the answer for the Republican Party to win the White House is in our governors. You know, we got to get outside of Washington. We need people who have gotten things done, who have executive experience. But are we now seeing the downside of that? None of those, if you're a governor, you don't have foreign policy experience unless you were a senator first, you know. Even Jeb Bush, you know, you look at the foreign policy address that he gave a few weeks ago, 3/4 of that speech is about the domestic economy, saying that if our economy was strong, we'd be stronger foreign policy-wise. And he didn't really go very deep on what he would do about ISIS or Syria or anything like that. Just said we gotta you know, put him in a noose and take him out. So are we seeing? Is there going to be an opening here for Rubio? I would think less maybe for a Paul or a Cruz. But as far as if you want someone with foreign policy experience who also has some domestic credibility too, I mean, Rubio is sort of the only guy left. You're not going to go for John Bolton just on foreign policy, I assume.
Right.
Colleen Fiorina doesn't bring you any foreign policy experience, so she doesn't bring much experience about anything. Are people going to start wondering, can a governor go the distance when there's all this anxiety about ISIS?
Well, first I would say that Colleen Fiorina seems to be impressing a lot of people. She seems like sort of, you know how Mike Huckabee in 2008 kind of came out of nowhere and made a name for himself and was able to parlay. He didn't win in 2008, of course, but he's able to parlay that into kind of bigger and better things. And one gets the sense that Colleen Fiorina may be the Mike Huckabee of this cycle, whereas others like Dr. Ben Carson or others could be maybe more like the Michelle Bachmann or Herman Cain of this cycle. We'll see how that shakes out. It's early on. Look, I think that governors, you know, there's a trope that people don't vote on foreign policy. I think that's probably true and probably still true. I think that governors are generally preferred, especially in the Republican Party, but there needs to be there's a threshold of knowledge and credibility and competence that they must meet. And so they don't have to necessarily, you know, nobody's going to be, you know, a foreign policy expert to the degree, you know, if that were what mattered, then maybe Lindsey Graham would win the nomination, right? So I don't think you have to be the expert, but I do think that there's essentially a threshold you have to meet. And right now there's a danger that Scott Walker is not able to meet that threshold. I mean, I think Rick Perry stumbled last time and has boned up on the issues, and we'll see how he does this time. But, you know, he was a governor, obviously, the longest serving governor in America. So, you know, yeah, I look, and let's go to, you know, you mentioned Rubio. I will say, you know, I spoke to a source in Florida, not attending the conference, but somebody very, very connected in Florida politics who told me, you know, don't expect Rubio to run for reelection. He doesn't think he likes being in the Senate, that it's going to be, you know, president or governor. And, you know, Rubio, you know, I mean, I would say he hit a home run in Florida, except for the fact that he is so good most of the time. I mean, you know, it's hard to continue to be impressed by his eloquent speeches when he gives them, you know, so frequently. But
His eloquence is not being appreciated, it would seem, by the Republican primary voters. He's still not polling very well.
Well, you know, I think, you know, you cannot underestimate the damage that the immigration reform thing did to him. It was... it was brutal. But on the other hand, you know, it's a crucible, and you get the sense that Rubio, for example, is much more prepared to handle adverse situations than Scott Walker, because, you know, Walker may have faced, you know, the left in Wisconsin, and I'm sure it was brutal, but Rubio has been through the ringer, taking on the national press and his own side, and come out of that experience. It's not just Rubio who's more prepared, but his team is more prepared, more professional. And so they've been through some trials. So even though I think the immigration reform thing was incredibly damaging for Rubio, one potential benefit is that, you know, he's been tried even through these tests.
Now, Mark Salter, who was a longtime McCain right-hand man, co-author of Faith in My Fathers, with him on the 2008 campaign trail, he wrote on Facebook after, I think, Scott Walker's comment about you know, protesters and ISIS, I want to like Scott Walker, but he's kind of a dumbass. And this got picked up by Business Insider. I then took the Business Insider article and I tweeted out the quote. And that got picked up by Michelle Malkin's Twitchy operation.
And I got all these conservative... Your old college buddy.
Right, my old pal. And so I got all these conservative tweeters, you know, attacking me for, I go, ah, oh, you think you're so smart. We all love Scott Walker even more now. You're just Mark Salter. Who wants to listen to that loser, Mark Salter? This proves that Walker's a winner. And I was like, dude, I'm just tweeting out a quote. You know, I'm not, I'm not doing much beyond that. Do you, seeing him up close, I mean, you're talking about him using this as a crutch and all that kind of thing. Is this a strategic misstep on Scott Walker's part, or is he just not that bright and will not become bright over the course of this process? Because a strategic miscalculation can be recalibrated. If you're not bright, you're not bright.
First, let me say, you know, I'm not an economist. I mean, I'm not an economist, and I have a general understanding of free market economics. I mean, I'm sure, but I'm not, you know, I'm not a wonk in that regard. But some of the people I talked to in Florida, even though Walker's speech was wonky, the people who really are fiscal experts were not impressed by that part of the speech. They felt it was talking points and stump speech and nothing new, nothing interesting, that it was just perfunctory. So nobody was happy with his speech. It was generally panned for a variety of different reasons. I do not think Scott Walker is stupid. I think that Scott Walker is a smart person. I don't think he's, I don't want to name names, but look, there are people on the right who are just not serious. And I do not think Scott Walker fits into that category. I think he is a serious person. But he is a governor of Wisconsin who is now thrust into a presidential campaign. And, you know, I just don't think there's enough time for him to meet this steep learning curve. Like, I think that he has been... He had to win three elections in 4 years. And I just don't think he has the reservoir of knowledge about, you know, international issues, for example, philosophy, whatever, theology, just all the different things that you have to sort of know to survive in today's media environment. And I don't think there's enough time for him to get up to speed. Doesn't mean he's stupid. I think he's a smart guy, but he's basically going from, you know, the Frederick Keys to Yankee Stadium, okay? And now they're throwing not just 100-mile-per-hour fastballs, but ungodly breaking balls. And I just don't think, maybe I'm wrong, but I just don't think, it's not to say that, I mean, Walker's great, but I just don't think there's enough time for him to get up to speed to play at that level.
I appreciate your allusions to Bull Durham, by the way.
That's right. Good catch, Bill. Love that movie.
I'm not completely culturally illiterate.
Well, but that movie's so old now that people don't...
maybe it's evidence that I am culturally illiterate.
I love Bull Durham.
So let's shift away from the Republicans for a second. I have a piece up at Politico today called What If Hillary Bows Out? This is coming on the heels of the flaps around the fundraising for the Clinton Foundation, getting money from foreign governments, and now the story that she did not use a state.gov email address as Secretary of State. She used a ClintonEmail.com address that was housed in her house, and some debate whether that violates the law or not. There's a 2009 regulation from the National Archives Administration, if I'm not butchering the name of the agency, saying that you can have a private email address so long as you're preserving your records. And I guess it's a little fuzzy what preserving your records means. How do you prove that? How is that enforceable? It's not like this, like you have 5 years in jail if you don't preserve your records. And so, you know, she could be preserving them and just not giving them to you. It doesn't mean she's violating the rule in that respect. It just means that they don't have a lot of access to them. So I think there's a bit of murkiness around that, but it's still raising a lot of questions. Why do this? Is this about Benghazi? Is this about some other kind of conspiracy out there? How is she handling it? Is this going to raise people's concerns that she's going to make some of the similar stumbles that she made in 2008? So, you know, my piece didn't get deep into those particulars. It was more about, you know, just assume she doesn't run. I'm not even saying it's a likely possibility or anything, but just assume she doesn't run. You know, what does the party do? Is the party prepared for that circumstance? There was a column by Russ Duthat last June that said, you know, there is no alternative was the title, that the Democratic Party was this
an allusion to Margaret Thatcher, we should note.
The party was just sort of this balkanized mess, and it's only being stitched together by Hillary. And if she wasn't there, Duthat said, without her, the deluge. And actually, my piece was actually pushing back on that. I don't think the party is that woefully divided. I think there is a fair amount of ideological common ground, and where there is division, there's a high tolerance for difference of opinion that doesn't that prevents the party from descending into a bloody civil war. I mean, you're seeing right now, you know, a pretty vigorous debate, intra-party debate over trade. But it's not Obama is destroying the party and I disown him if he produces the Trans-Pacific trade partnership. You know, it's isolated that issue. It doesn't necessarily spill out into a larger, bloodbath. So, if Hillary did back away, on one hand, you would have this immediate push for Elizabeth Warren. You have this draft Warren infrastructure already in place. But you seem to have a reluctant candidate in Warren, so she wouldn't necessarily jump in 24 hours after Hillary withdrawal. And you probably have more ambitious characters out there, like maybe a Kristen Gillibrand or Andrew Cuomo or Joe Biden or maybe even Deval Patrick. I would imagine you'd have people jumping in way sooner then Warren would jump in, if she even jumped in at all. And I think you see this year the advantages of first mover advantage. You know, Jeb Bush jumps in December and he locks down a whole lot of infrastructure and money right away, and also gets the benefit of being able to make a few misses, a few whiffs, if you will, in his speeches, and they don't completely consume him. Whereas if you're a late entry, like Rick Perry in 2012 or Wesley Clark in 2004, you make this big grand entrance being the last guy in, and then any little error you make is just completely overblown.
That's a great point.
A lot of hype, and then the fall is...
That's a great point. And every cycle, it seems like there's this theory that getting in late is smart and you can bypass all the whatever. And you're right. It just doesn't seem to work.
I mean, back in the day, you could kind of show up at the convention, you know, a week before, and then kind of work it out in the back room. And,
right,
you know, these days you can't really do that. You got to go through your paces. So I think there's that there's that element that would probably be a factor against Warren getting the nod. And
this
there's just the
is,
bigger
this is, by the
fundamental
way,
party.
This is, by the way, why I don't like going to the closer in baseball. And we saw this happen in Washington with the Nationals, where there was a starting pitcher who was just coasting along. And the manager pulled him and brought in the stopper, who promptly gives up a hit or a home run, I forget. But if someone had, you know, you either have good stuff or you don't. And if you've got your momentum going, I say stick with the hot hand, you know. And if you get in, take, you know, you give up a couple hits early and then the first inning or second inning, it's not a deal breaker. And then you catch your groove. Why do you bring in someone off the bench who hasn't been warmed up? You know, I don't know. It's a weird analogy, but I'm sticking with it.
I mean, if you're going to be a closer, if you're going to come in late, you got to get your strikes right away. You
no
give one home run, that's it. You have not done your job. And you know, the day Warren jumps in, whatever day it is, the first media interview she does, I guarantee you she'll be bombarded with questions about what are you going to do about ISIS. It's not going to be what are you going to do about Wall Street. What are you going to do about ISIS? It's not going to be in her wheelhouse. They're going to test her to see how does she perform outside of her wheelhouse. And if she hasn't knocked it out of the park, she would have a very hard time. And look, the thing about an ISIS or Syria question is that they're trick questions because there are no good answers. There's no proper way to answer that question. So you're sort of doomed to fail.
Right.
And
not to belabor the point, but, you know, go back to the Scott Walker thing. You know, he was asked about something that wasn't in his wheelhouse and he didn't handle it. And then there's the voters don't, you know, I mean, Elizabeth Warren could say, well, voters don't care about that. They care about, you know, the crony capitalism and, you know, Wall Street or, you know, whatever. No, you have to be able to answer.
Now your position of dictating what voters care about, and voters can say, wait a second, maybe I do care about that. You don't get to tell me what I care about, what I don't care about.
Well, and even if they care more about the economy, it doesn't mean that they don't also care a bit about ISIS, you know, I mean, to elect,
right.
You are electing a commander in chief as well. So,
but so that's sort of like the political timing element. I think there's a deeper question about would the party accept a Warren nomination? You know, is there this big war between the populist and the corporate leaning centrists? And so on one hand, I argue that it's not a war. There's plenty of overlap. There's tensions, but there's overlap and there's tolerance of differences of opinion. But I think there is also a thirst for pragmatism that, you know, even, you know, you can say, you know, Obama was a more of a liberal candidate than Clinton was. But both of them had their populist rhetoric and both of them had their tempering of that rhetoric with elements of pragmatism in the campaign. And I think that puts both donors at ease and it puts primary voters at ease because they want to win. You know, like Democrats have ever since the 80s, they're pretty focused on winning. They're not always going for, you know, the pipe dream. And, you know, Warren's stock and trade is to be uncompromising, to push the boundary of debate. And there's obviously a role for that in the party, but does that fly as a presidential candidate? You might well see a candidate come in saying, look, I agree with a lot of what she says. I agree about taking on the banks and I agree about closing the wealth gap. But I would do it in this way. I think we can do this in a way that would be more effective and practical and doable. I would suspect there'd be a lot more room for that sort of candidate than a Warren style candidate. Even if Warren's sort of driving the party and sort of moving them in her direction, whether she could actually have the prize herself, I think, is more dubious. So that's where I kind of came out, disagreeing with Duth that the party couldn't handle the loss of Hillary. But I don't know if Matt, if you think perhaps I'm being a little too green eye shade and I'm overlooking the deep divides that rack the party.
Well, no, I don't think that. But I mean, I think it's just interesting. You've got Hillary, who is, I guess you could say, doing the Rose Garden thing, you know, just sort of coasting to the nomination, trying to stay, keep her head down, and rather than being ignored and overlooked, it seems like this has invited scrutiny and attention. I still, and you've got the weird, really weird juxtaposition between the Democratic Party, who has the one candidate, Hillary, the presumptive nominee, who at least appears to be a very strong and historic candidate, versus the scrum on the right, with the Republicans having this incredibly deep bench, but none of them of Hillary's stature. So much more diverse bench, but nobody, not even Jeb, I think, who, and so then the question is, would you rather have the kind of embarrassment of riches on the right of people fighting it out, trying to become the nominee? I mean, does that adversity make you stronger? Does that free market competition make you stronger? Whereas Hillary will be harmed by the kind of protectionist fact that she doesn't have to compete, that she doesn't have to get up to speed, that she can lay low. Or on the other hand, would you argue that Hillary still is in the better position, assuming she actually runs? I still say, now there is the historic problem too of trying to win the third, of a political party trying to win a third term, something that's very difficult to do. The last time it happened was 1988 when Bush got Reagan's third term. If you don't count FDR, getting his own third term, I think you have to go back like 100 years or something to find the last guy who, the last time it happened. So,
But Truman did build on FDR, so I think you can count that era as a time when the successor was able to keep it going.
still, it's the exception to the rule. It doesn't happen often. It's more likely that after two terms, the country's ready to change. So, look, I think maybe this is me being pessimistic. I mean, I think if I had to pick, if I had to pick which scenario, I would still go with the Democrats in the short term. I would still like my chances of winning with Hillary better than my chances of winning with the Republican winning. But that may just be me being being pessimistic.
Well, I talked in the last political thing that I wrote, whether the Republican primary debate was going to encourage Hillary to come in sooner or later. I had said if they were having a robust and enlightening debate that was sort of making everyone look good, where everyone's sort of outdoing each other for with their brilliant policy ideas, Hillary might say, "I better get in this. These guys are getting a free pass, and I can't let them get a leg up on me." But if it was another kind of clown car situation where they're all humiliating themselves, I'm going to stand back and let them, humiliate themselves. I would argue since I wrote that, there's been, particularly with the Scott Walker stuff, enough bad press that Hillary might be inclined to hang back. But now with these kerfuffles, you're now seeing a big downside. You're
When's
now
the last,
getting
but let me ask
you're
you, Bill,
being treated like a candidate. You're getting hammered like a candidate, and you're not out there defending yourself like a candidate.
I mean, you study history pretty closely as a journalist. I mean, when's the last time a party fight was elevated? I mean, isn't it much more likely that it's ugly than that it's elevated?
Well, I mean, it's never pretty, but I would argue that the 2008 primary, as bitter and unpleasant as it was at the time for Democrats, you still had, they were fighting over should we have an individual mandate for universal health care or should it be a universal health care without individual mandate? It was still a policy debate that was going on. It still showed the party's interest in the issue and their commitment to the issue. And so at the end of the day, it didn't make them look like they were a weak party. So I think there are ways you can have a tough debate that still highlight the strengths of your party.
Right.
I don't think Republicans had that in 2012.
This brings us to the other issue, and I kind of roll my eyes every time conservatives bring up the liberal media, but I think it is interesting because clearly the media is willing to report on liberal scandals. And the case of Hillary in the past week, we've had these two scandals, both of which are quite serious, potentially quite serious. I feel like the problem is in the execution. In other words, the media will initially report on liberal scandals, but I feel like by and large, and there are exceptions like the Monica Lewinsky story, which is irresistible, but by and large, they don't get the same feeding frenzy. Somebody will come along with a think piece that says, well, actually, it's smart. You know, Ezra Klein or somebody will write the think piece. Actually, it's smart for Hillary to have her own email account. Or, you know, they'll have this like, you know,
I've seen at least three of those already.
Yeah, the contrarian like think piece, you know. Now, again, if it was a Republican who had a personal email account, who was doing official business, they, you know, this would be a scandal that would last for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I feel like, I don't know if the left is better at knocking it down. I suspect it's their willing accomplices in the media who get the hit for the original story, but don't pursue it with the same glee as if it's a Republican. But I do feel like without bitching and moaning about it, because that doesn't do us much good, I do feel like it's incorrect to say that the media doesn't cover liberal scandals, but I don't think they sort of have the feeding frenzy around them that they do on the
now
media.
As you might suspect, I think there are a lot of folks on the left that reject that premise.
Yeah, but what do you think? You're really like truthfully, is there anything to it, or is this all in the eye of the beholder?
Well, I mean, certainly with me, I mean, there's sort of like a special case when it comes to Clinton's, because we've been dealing with, you know, Clinton scandals, quote unquote, for you know, three decades now, and there's a general critique on the left that the media has this Clinton narrative that they're always up to something, and that every little ticky tack thing immediately gets put into this conspiracy framework. And that makes mountains out of molehills. And we went through an entire presidency, you know, going after Whitewater, which turned out to be just a pretty podunk land deal. It didn't work out, and there was nothing untoward about it. So now are we going to go through this again with you know, fundraising for a charity and having an email system that, you know, as some say, other secretaries of state have had in the past to some degree.
Right.
You know, that's the argument you're getting on the left.
There really are serious potential problems with it. If it were used to avoid FOIA requests, the other danger of it not being encrypted, and that it could be open or up to hacking, you know, by foreign governments or whatnot. I mean,
I agree. I mean, this is a legitimate story. Now, maybe the breathless nature of it maybe should be scaled back a bit until you actually had like a real smoking gun of some sort. But it's a story. It's clearly worth pursuing.
I would say that it's possible that my frustration with the media has something to do with that there's a, you know, Obama is a Teflon president, like the way that Reagan supposedly was a Teflon president. That maybe it's sort of unique to Obama in the last, you know, 6 years that these scandals would pop up about Obama, but none of them would really stick to him. And maybe that's kind of feeding my perception more than it otherwise would. And maybe, as you imply, maybe it won't hold true for Hillary. Maybe these scandals really will stick to her in a way that they haven't to Obama.
I just don't think at the end of the day, this is a media question. I mean, I think there are ways the media handle these things, which are, I think, slightly different depending on the person involved. I don't think it's clearly like they treat liberals lighter than conservatives. I think they have a Clinton narrative and they have an Obama narrative and they had a George W. Bush narrative, and things kind of fit into that for the media. But there's also the question of how the candidates themselves handle these situations. The Clintons handle it in a certain way and Obama's handled his in a certain way. I think Obama's handled his situations in a defter way, where partly because I think they were easier to defend. I think his issues were really trumped up, and his staff was able to prosecute his case very quietly to journalists, make sure they had their view of the facts in front of them, and so they would at least get reported in the stories, and that kind of diffused the intensity of the coverage, the Clinton folks tend to get a little more bunker early on, and that stokes more suspicion, rightly or wrongly, and that tends to drag these things out more. They survive them. They always survive them.
I've said this,
the classic essence.
I mean, I've said this before, Bill, but I think part of it is there's a downside to being interesting. And I think that Obama's strategy has by and large been to like, oh, no, that's boring, nothing to see here. And to sort of downplay things. I mean, if you know, I've said it before, if you went to Jay Carney and said your house is on fire, he would be like, well, you know, we've known all along this was a possibility. Fires happen occasionally, Jake, you know that. But this isn't, you know, the president's been very clear from day one that we're not going to let this. I mean, that's sort of the insouciance. Whereas I think the Clintons are kind of cursed by the fact that they're interesting and charismatic, and that invites, rather than dampen down on scrutiny and inquiry, it sort of invites it and feeds the fire.
I mean, there's also a rap on the Clintons that they're consummate operators, that they're Machiavellian. And so if there's something like this going on, there must be some seedy reason behind it. And we have to go dig into that reason. And Obama's, narrative has never been that.
These narratives do stick. I'll give you an example that's totally unrelated. But I just this weekend again ran into people who would swear on a stack of Bibles that they saw Tucker Carlson 2 weeks ago on Fox wearing a bow tie. He hasn't worn a bow tie in 7 years, but people would, I mean, these are good, honest people who would swear on a stack of Bibles that they saw him a week ago wearing a bow tie on TV. And it shows you once a brand is set, it is really hard to shake that brand.
Now, I think in the case of the Clintons, that might also be their shield, because I think people say, yeah, Clintons are operators. So what? Politicians are politicians. What are you going to do? I'm sure she did something funny with her emails. I don't care. What's she going to do about the economy?
Yeah.
So
it's baked into Jillian's the cake. Yeah.
Right.
I agree. Now, it's a double-edged sword.
Now, before we go, I got to leave in about 10 minutes, but I do want to get your take on what's happened in Congress this week. I know you're out of town. I know you're stuck outside the Beltway. But you had this remarkable day yesterday where you had Bibi Netanyahu give a foreign policy speech to the joint meeting of Congress, essentially to attack the president's foreign policy, which is, I think, wholly unprecedented. To have a foreign head of state come and attack the president on the floor of the House. But in the middle of all that hubbub, Boehner completely capitulates on the whole Homeland Security immigration fight and passes a bill to fund Homeland Security with no riders of any sort, and surrendering on the question of Obama's immigration executive action, and seemingly with no repercussion, no talk of revolt or coup or anything like that. Do you have any insight? And are people saying, hooray for Boehner, he stuck it to Obama on Iran? Or are they saying, boo for Boehner, he's a total weenie when it comes to immigration? You know, what's going on?
It's the latter. It's the latter. Boehner can do, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter what Boehner does and McConnell. They will never be good enough. They will never be tough enough.
Narratives.
The base does not trust them, does not like them, assumes they're selling out. I have no reason to be loyal or partial to Boehner. All I can say is, I just, I don't know what he could have done different. I mean, we talked about this the other week, Bill, but like, number one, he can't, you know, unless if we lived in a country where Democrats, where there was bipartisan outrage, where people weren't tribal. And there was a time in this country when people, you know, would have said, look, President Obama has overreached his executive authority. He's trampling on the balance of power. And so as a Democrat, I'm going to come out and stop that. If there were enough Democrats who were willing to take that step, and I think that would be heroic and the appropriate thing to do, then Vayner would have some power. But because that's not true, I think I went through the list of obstacles last week, but like, number one, you can't pass it because you need 60 votes to pass it through the Senate. Number two, if you try to defund even the part of DHS that would affect Obama's executive order, you can't because that's paid for by fees. Number three, this is like in Ocean's 11 when it's like, we got to go down the elevator, which we can't go down, and get into the safe, which you can't because it's protected by, you know, it's like, if somehow you did get enough Democrats to, you know, to not filibuster this and to pass it through the Senate, then President Obama would veto it, right? So then you need to override the veto, which you're not going to be able to do. Then let's say you did defund part of DHS, and God forbid there were some sort of a terrorist attack, as we talked about last. Just like, there's so many obstacles that this is like literally impossible to do. And if Jim DeMint were the Speaker of the House, or if Jim DeMint were the Senate Majority Leader, if Ted Cruz were the Senate Majority Leader or the Speaker of the House, I cannot fathom any way that they could have done things any differently or gotten this passed.
They could have gone over the cliff. They could actually defund it. And then you get blamed for defunding Homeland Security in a time of international crisis.
But it still wouldn't stop. But it still wouldn't stop Obama. The only thing that right now is stopping Obama's order is the court decision, right? But so even if they did go over the cliff, it still wouldn't have stopped Obama's executive overreach.
Well, that's what's so nuts about. I mean, the charge in Obama was that he was running roughshod over our system of checks and balances. Once the court stepped in and Obama adhered to the court stay, that's not an argument anymore. You had your escape hatch, okay? Obama's reined in. This is being litigated in the proper sphere of our system. Let's let it play out there and move on with our business. You know, that should be an easy way to get out of the whole pickle.
What I'm saying is, like, I'm with the, you know, the conservative base on this. Like, I think that what Obama did was overstepping his bounds. And I think there ought to be some recourse, the co-equal branch of government ought to have some recourse. So I'm like, I'm with him up to that point. But then the question is like, what can you actually do? And the only thing they can do is to hurt themselves, as far as I can tell. The only thing Republicans could do is marginally hurt themselves and potentially majorly hurt themselves. But no matter what they do, they can't actually stop, as far as I can figure out, this from happening. So
as you are a pessimist, if I can shift gears for a little bit,
it's safer that way, Bill. It's safer.
Is there any downside for Republicans having orchestrated this this BB speech? Or is this just all upside? People will stand Israel over Iran. Obama's is a weenie pacifist who's going to ruin everything. And this puts Republicans on the right side of history. Or is there a risk for them here?
Well, there's a risk to anything you do. I mean, there's a risk for walking across the street in the morning. But I think this was well worth it. I mean, I think it was the right thing to do. And the people who are, you know, pearl clutching and wringing their hands over this can go right ahead. This is, in my opinion, entirely appropriate, and if it's not, then so be it. I mean, if it hurts them politically, which I don't think it will, then so be it. I think that it was appropriate and the right thing to do.
I doubt there'd be a short-term political cost for Republicans. I mean, what happens in Israel is sort of, you know, beyond my pay grade, but it will get very interesting, assuming an actual deal is forged by the end of the month. Because I think on one hand, people are sympathetic to Israel and not trusting Iran. At the same time, nobody wants to see a war. And I think Bibi's speech failed to convince that if you didn't have a deal, that the next step would not be war, because he didn't really have much of an alternative plan except for, you know, more sanctions and get a better deal. And well, and the response is, what if Iran then, you know, moves for to get a bomb in a month because there's no constraints on them? What do you do then? And that's sort of left unanswered in the Bibi speech. So you have these cross currents that I think in the American electorate that I think Obama has an answer for. And what Republicans then say at that point will be very interesting. I think they're gonna have a hard time articulating why to sabotage the deal would not lead to an extremely bloody situation.
Well, again, not to play Scott Walker or Barack Obama and say it's above our pay grade, but this is obviously a serious topic. And we don't know everything that there is to know about it, but just in terms of the political optics, it's the least of Republicans' concerns. But as you do allude to, I mean, you know, the sort of political angle is only a minor facet of this. I mean, there's huge geopolitical and, you know, things at play here. So,
and what Hillary has to say about it will also be interesting, because she's been more of an Iran skeptic. You know, she had said to Jeffrey Goldberg at the Atlantic, you know, there's no right to enrich. Iran shouldn't assert a right to enrich. I assume there's going to be some degree of enrichment in this deal. But Hillary did not side with Chuck Schumer and Bob Menendez in trying to push a sanctions bill. Now she said, "Let the negotiations play out. Let's see where they lead. Don't kill it prematurely." What she says after a deal is struck will be very, very interesting to see, because I think that's a real unknown. She's tried pretty hard to minimize daylight between herself and Obama, which is this a point for her to break from him, or a chance? And I mean, I think you see in the Democratic Party a pretty decent amount of support for what Obama's doing. I mean, you have this breakaway faction with Schumer and Menendez, but overall, I think people are really siding with Obama here and think this could be a real capstone to his foreign policy legacy. So it'd be pretty dicey for Hillary to cut against it.
Oh, I agree. And if she had that sort of sister soldier moment, it also harkens back to her vote. I don't think this is fair, but I think it harkens back to her vote on Iraq as well. And so I think the context, I don't know that she has the liberty to distance herself from Obama on this issue, because it just reminds everyone of the last time she was on the wrong side of Obama.
Fair point. All right, I got to jump.
All right. Good talking.
Take care.
All right. See y'all later.